Good morning and welcome to episode 59 of the Crackin' Backs podcast with your hosts, Dr. Terry Wyman and Dr. Spencer Barron. How are you guys doing this morning?
Good, Lance.
Good, Lance. How are you?
Doing great. So today, we are joined by Brian Hixon. Brian Hixon is one of the leading neuroscience experts in quantitative EEG brain mapping, neurocognitive testing, neurofeedback brain training, and nutritional cellular health. He's also the director of digital brain health for ShareCare/DrOz.com, the founder and director of the Brain Performance Centers of Southern California, and an EEG brain mapping contractor for the U.S. Army. How are you doing this morning, Brian?
Doing well, Lance. We need to add a little bit more on there just to mess you up a little
bit. Yeah, that was a fun labyrinth.
Yeah, I think we need to... I think we need to talk about you and maybe helping our engineer, you know, get that brain cognitive thinking.
Hey, I think my brain is just fine. I don't drink. I don't do any drugs. I play piano regularly. I read. I think I'm doing good.
I think we're going to interview Lance instead. Sorry, Brian. You're out.
I guess so.
So, Lance, tell me, how does this drinking problem, or not drinking problem, start?
Well, my father beat me as a child. And
So, Brian, anyway, how are you today?
Doing great. Doing great.
Hey, Brian. Hey, thanks for being on our show. I really appreciate it. I want to get into how we met, but also brain mapping is one of your expertise. And when I first met you, probably 20-some years ago, probably 18 years ago, you were really working with a lot of the athletes from Red Bull and different high-intensity sports, and my son was racing motorcycles at the time. And I remember hearing about this guy who was working with athletes, not only to help them recover mentally from severe injuries, you know, the PTSD that comes with severe injuries, but also giving them that mental edge. And my son had suffered a couple of crashes, and I wanted to kind of jump on board. And that was before anybody was really doing stuff that I had heard of. I mean, it wasn't my expertise. It wasn't where I was going as a chiropractor, but I found it very fascinating of how neurofeedback and how brain mapping was working. And over the years we've talked and shared. And then with this podcast, we ran into one of Dr. Barron's good friends, Dr. Bagnell, and it brought it back up to the surface for me a lot more. And I think, especially with the last couple of years, everyone's brain changed, not just athletes, not just people that suffered traumatic injuries. And so one of the reasons I want to hear how your journey in brain mapping came about.
How the journey came about. It's a long journey, but I will shorten it up so it doesn't bore everybody too much. But I got into this mainly in the healthcare side, mainly for looking at migraines, looking at chronic pain. We had a large physical medicine office and looking at all those things that, you know, where medicine didn't have an answer, right? Where, you know, everything looked fine, yet people were still experiencing tremendous amount of pain, nerve pain, all the way to concussion type activity as well. And got into that and really from there was introduced with a couple of professors down at Pepperdine that were working with Red Bull on a lot of sport concussion and interesting stuff, even on peak performance. And so got involved with them, and they hired us to come down here and really start working with Red Bull. And that was a great, great time because we had access to so many athletes. You know, we got to brain map all these athletes, really start establishing baselines of what their brains look like. And a brain map, again, is looking at the electrical activity of the brain. So it's really looking at rest, how well is that brain firing? Is it coming down to a nice idle state? Or is there a part of the brain that's left full on neurons firing away, and which obviously is going to fatigue you? That'd be like, you know, you sitting there at rest and having, you know, your right arm fully flexed. You know, it's going to fatigue it very quickly and cause problems. And so we can look at that baseline state and really started looking at athletes, how well they can shift from a more neutral kind of relaxed state to a, you know, engaged state. And that would be, again, you know, I think everybody that's involved in, you know, weightlifting or even just exercise seriously knows the value of recovery. And the value of recovery is just as important and as the intensity of the workout. And for athletes, a lot of time in the brain, and I think let's not even just athletes, right? Everybody. We all go so much. Our culture drives us to productivity all the time, but we never practice coming back down. And so the problem is our brains get stuck in this state, and it fatigues us. It ruins our sleep. It makes us have overthinking, overanalyzing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the problem is when the brain stuck, especially the back of the brain, the temporal lobes, when they're stuck up in a fight or flight state, it actually, you know, constricts our muscles. A lot of people think that the muscles just constrict on their own. The brain is the only thing that constricts the muscles. And so many people say, gosh, I carry all my stress in my neck and shoulders. Well, a lot of times, I mean, obviously it can be a mechanical thing that you just got an injury. But a lot of times it's just the stress of our brain that just keeps constricting it up and causing that much.
Hey, Brian, let me ask you, you know, they talk about rest being a... No, you know what? I'm going to ask you that after. Let me ask you this first. What areas are you, when you measure, is it hemispheres, is it sections, or is it real more precise areas of the brain that can determine, you know, anything in particular, low energy levels or high energy? What are you measuring?
So we're measuring definitely regions of the brain, typically lobes of the brain. But we are measuring all the way down to very precise. My 5-year-old's right here too. So, but uh-oh. We're measuring very precise regions of the brain, all the way down to about a square inch of the brain. So, you know, where we can actually see where the problem is. But the general functions of the brain are a little bit more towards regions. You know, there's not. I don't think you can get that precise on a function, but you can get very precise on where an area is overfunctioning, where the problem area is. And that's what you need to really train it.
Sorry. So for the listening audience to really hone in on, when you're measuring, and you give me an example of what you might find and how you might manage somebody, and then I'll ask some other questions after that.
Yeah. So, you know, I always explain to people that an EEG brain map is basically like an EKG of the heart. Okay. When you're measuring your resting state heart rate, it's an important thing to have it very nice and a normal level, okay? Because there's a physiological threshold up here that when that heart rate gets too high, you hit that. So if your resting state is too high, you're very close to that threshold and you're trying to manage that constantly, just stay right underneath it. And that's what a lot of medication tries to do. That's what a lot of things try and do. And so what we want is to not help people manage that. We want to lower that down to here, okay? So that you have lots of reserve and can handle this. Okay. And so the same thing with the brain. Your brain's electrical activity, when it's already so high, people wonder why, gosh, why just I experience a little bit of stress and I'm having this fight or flight, this panic attack, this all these things. You know, even migraines. Migraines are in the brain, the electrical activity in the temporal lobes, that they're hitting this physiological threshold. It starts to cause a vascular constriction and dilation of the blood vessels in the brain when you hit that level. And most people are trying to manage that migraine right there. I know my trigger. My trigger is here. I use medication to keep it there. You know, I always tell people you don't want to get rid of a migraine. Actually, if you got rid of a migraine, you would actually go on to have a seizure. Okay. So migraine is shutting you down, kind of like a breaker switch on your house, shuts down the electrical overload before there's a fire. We want to take you and get your resting state electrical activity down here. So you can have all those triggers, hormonal triggers, biological triggers, things you eat, all those things, and you're way down here.
And when you're doing you over the edge, so that's right. Cool. I like that.
Yeah. So and when you're doing the brain mapping, go ahead.
No, I was just going to add in reference to that. So if you find someone that, like, give the listeners an example. If you find an area of the brain, you know, maybe the, you know, emotional centers or the, you know, memory center or how you find something, how would you take care of it? If you can give an example, maybe that can make it like a condition related example.
So, okay. So so like yesterday I had a client that had all kinds of anxiety, okay, huge amounts of anxiety. And when we mapped her brain, we saw that it was all on the back of the brain. Okay, so high activity in the back of the brain, all these fight or flight. Now, that's a different form of anxiety because that's where the visual processing is. So for that person, when that area is left on over-processing, all sensory input is being exaggerated. It's being exacerbated. It's so much input hitting the brain that she can't concentrate at school. She can't read. She can't do anything. Everything is over-exacerbated. So, you know, and that becomes a problem. And we need to lower, there's really no rest on the eyes. And then when I asked her, I said, you know, how's your vision? She said, oh, I'm going to the eye doctor like every 3 months right now. It just keeps getting worse and worse. And, you know, I always tell people, it's funny how everybody thinks the eyes are the main part of vision. The eyes are lenses that take the, you know, through the optic nerve, send light back to the brain. The brain does the visual processing. And without looking at the brain, mm-hmm. you know, we're just keep correcting the lenses to make it easier on the brain. And we're not really hitting the true nature of the problem. So that's like one, you know, thing where without brain mapping, we would just probably look at, oh, she has anxiety. Here's an SSRI, put you on anti-anxiety medication. And go, and that wouldn't have affected anything because her frontal portion of her brain was absolutely fine. It was just over-processing visually.
How would you take care of that?
So, you know, I usually try and look at this holistically, right? A lot of people, you know, they do neurofeedback. It's just all about neurofeedback. And I really try and look at it holistically. You know, if there is diffuse activity across the whole brain, there's usually some cellular issue, right? There's not some injury. There's a cellular issue, neuroinflammation. You know, could be a blockage of the cerebral spinal fluid. There could be a lot of things, a nutritional deficiency that can cause that. So, you know, that's why I like, you know, working with Terry and stuff too, because, you know, sometimes it's a chiropractic thing where we've got to give, you know, that spinal adjustment and unleash that cerebral spinal fluid and allow that to flow properly and can get cord, especially after concussions or whiplash and stuff like that can happen. Sometimes if it's real high activity, it can be a magnesium deficiency. You know, magnesium, if it's real high, you know, that's neurons firing off all the time, constantly firing off. It's like a muscle fully flexed all the time. Neurons can't fire off without fuel. The fuel that fuels neurons typically is going to be calcium. Calcium's flying in through the calcium ion channel and flooding that neuron with the fuel it needs to fire off. Now, we don't want to get rid of calcium in your diet. You need calcium. But magnesium sits on the outside of the calcium ion channel and opens that channel and closes it. So it's what regulates the flow of calcium into that channel. So a lot of times the deficiency of magnesium, once that you get an injury or start to have stress, sometimes those channels just start staying open and flooding in fuel. And then you don't have enough magnesium to start shutting it down. And so we can look at things like that. We can look if it's very focal activity. We can look at neurofeedback where we can place a single EEG sensor on that area of the brain and put it through a biofeedback response and actually train it down. So there's a lot of things you can do when you look at it holistically. I mean, I can't believe how much activity is due to, you know, inactivity, sedentary lifestyle, you know, not getting enough exercise, you know, aerobic exercise for 20 minutes. Unleashes what's called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor in the brain, which it's like miracle growth for the brain. It stimulates stem cell growth. It stimulates, you know, all these dendrite connections. And, you know, so many people aren't taking advantage of that at all. It's the easiest thing to do.
Hey, Brian, can you just for some of the newer audience, we keep talking about brain mapping and they've heard that term. Can you actually break it down? What is a brain map? Because I'll tell a patient, hey, we need to look map your brain, and they'll go, why? I go, well, if you want to drive to Vegas, you need a map, and we don't know what's wrong and why you have chronic pain or chronic tension. We need a map. Well, what does that mean? And so, can you tell the average person, you know, yes, they put you put something on the head and you put electrodes on. What are you actually looking for? So, what is a brain map?
All right. So real quickly, just if I had to break it down, a brain map looks like a swim cap, basically, that you pull on your head, and it has 19 EEG sensors in it spread out across that. Okay, those sensors are very much like a stethoscope. All they're doing is measuring the electrical activity that your brain's producing. Every time a neuron fires off more electricity, it produces it, we can pick that up on an EEG sensor. Okay, so it's not putting any electricity in your head. It's just like stethoscopes picking up the electricity your brain's producing. And there's 19 of them. and you sit there at rest for about 6 minutes with your eyes closed, and you do about 6 minutes with your eyes open, and we're measuring that. And it can measure that electrical state. Is it coming down to a nice rest? It would be very much like a 6 to 8 minute, you know, EKG on the heart. You're laying there and it's measuring your heart's rhythms and all the electrical activity and making sure that's coming down to a nice state and it's not overworking. You know, it looks at a lot of statistical things within the electrical activity to make sure it's in the good range. And then the most important part is it then compares that to a large normative controlled database, the largest in the world, and of your same age and gender. So now we're getting your brain's electrical activity compared to a normative database. And we're, you know, everybody asks, you know, well, my brain's better than everybody else's, so I don't want it to be average, right? I want it to be better. You know, and I always tell them, well, if you're an athlete, you still want your resting heart rate within a normal range. Yeah, now, if we put you at a stress test, maybe that's going to be a lot different. And when we do, you know, things with Red Bull or, you know, a lot of these professional sports teams or the U.S. Olympic team, we do a lot of more almost like a stress test where you might be, maybe you're shooting free throws and we're introducing all kinds of distraction around you and you've got to maintain a perfect state, you know, and things like that while you're doing that. So there's a lot of things we can push athletes to a limit, but generally we're looking at the resting state and making sure all that brain activity comes down within the normal. And that normal is a big range. It's a big range. We're looking for things within 1.5 standard deviations low to 1.5 standard deviations high. So we're looking for people to fall into about 90% of a bell curve would be in that normal range. And anything that's outside of that, you know, it can have some symptoms.
And you're looking at all waveforms of the brain. And you're also looking at, are we at rest? So we're cleaning out the brain and refreshing it versus people that can't clean out their brain. Correct?
That's exactly right. So there's different frequencies in the brain that control different things. So there's these low frequencies in the brain, these slow waves that control mainly sleep. And we can look at rest. You should still be producing enough of those. So if you're not producing enough of those at rest, it's not going to be strong enough when you go to sleep. And it's not going to come up through full sleep cycles. We can look at things like your fight or flight waves. And again, if your fight or flight waves are stuck way up, you're going to be very close to a threshold of hitting fight or flight and stress. We can look at things like, you know, like a good point is a lot of people ask, you know, how are you looking to see if I have a migraine when I don't have a migraine right now? Okay. So what I always tell them is what we're looking for is at rest, if the temporal lobes and the betas and high betas are way up here, they're producing so much electricity at rest, you're just right underneath having a migraine. So I can know that if you have a little bit more stress, you're going to have a migraine. So we're looking at that resting state. No one goes from completely in a normal range all the way up to here to have a migraine. They have high amounts already, and it's this accumulation that's staying up there, and then it triggers these things.
Love that. So, Brian, you're probably familiar with the recent study University of Michigan did on ACL injuries of anterior cruciate ligament injuries and how it changes the mapping of the brain. And I figure this is an appropriate study that was published only a couple months ago that describes how, you know, an ACL tear, you know, for those who don't know what an ACL tear is, it's a very critical ligament in the knee that allows for stability. And even a strain where it causes you or a sprain where it causes you to alter your gait, it automatically, or it starts changing the map to the brain. And usually if that mapping isn't corrected after, you know, the injury heals or after surgery, then the chances of you getting, I think it's like 85% wow. chance of you getting another injury.
Interesting.
So how would you change how would you change the mapping of the brain for someone to walk normally?
Yeah. So the good thing about the brain and the problem with the brain is that it's the best compensation injury or engine there is.
Okay. Yeah.
So as good soon point. As the muscular changes and things fire different, the brain compensates and then that becomes the new normal. And then that starts holding it in that place. So, you know, the brain, again, is controlling those muscles. It's controlling the constriction of those. And which obviously, you know, makes a big difference in how we walk, our motor function, and all of that. And so, you know, what's absolute best is to have a baseline on an athlete before they get an injury. It's a wonderful thing because then when they get an injury, we can train them right back to that. We know exactly where they were before. We can compare it to a normative database and see. You got to ask yourself, you know, did that person, what was that brain shifting and those changes due to this injury, or was it due to something in the previous 20 years before that? That's the problem. Without having a baseline, we don't know for sure. And, you know, we can go by symptoms. And if you never had those symptoms before, you know, had this injury, we can, you know, we can kind of correlate some of that information. But having a baseline on, you know, on an athlete, you know, we've had a large center at Oaks Christian School, a real large private school. That's, you know, one of the top in football and a lot of the different sports. And, you know, we worked with them to get a huge amounts of baselines of their student athletes so that if there is an injury or a concussion, but any type of injury, you know, the other problem with injuries is, you know, you can develop chronic pain too. And, right. You know, a lot of people think, oh, that injury healed, you're still having this pain, that's all in your head. And I always have to tell, there is no pain that's not in your head, okay? Pain always starts in your head. You know, in neuroscience, we can take a probe, you know, into a rat and we can probe a certain area and we can produce pain anywhere in your body. We can also cut certain areas and you can stab yourself and not feel any pain. So pain is all in your head. And, you know, in the parietal portion of the brain, the back of the head, when there's a lot of pain, that becomes in a hypervigilant state. It's processing all this nerve sensations and nerve pain coming through. And a lot of times when things heal, that stays up. The brain compensates and now it's become its new normal. It's almost like a post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, like we would see from maybe a war or from a trauma. It's from pain and it stays in that position. And then people, every nerve impulse that's coming through there is still interpreted as pain.
How would you treat that?
Well, you know, with that, usually we're going to look at with EEG neurofeedback, where we can place sensors in that area and we can actually train a person to calm it down. You know, we can meditate because we have a sense of awareness of our frontal lobe when it's calm and when it's stressed. Okay. The problem is the back of the brain, the temporal lobes, we have no sense of that. We don't know what's going on at all. I could sit there and try and meditate and I can't affect those areas because I have no awareness. But if I put a sensor in that area, I can put it through a computer screen and I can mirror that activity on a screen and I can see when it goes up and down. And then what we can do is we can attach a reward to the direction we want that to go. So if we want that activity to go down, we can put it through a video game that only goes forward when that activity goes down. So if it goes down 1%, now your brain activity is always going up and down 1% all the time. It's sitting there up and down. It stays down for 3 or 4 seconds and goes up 1%, 3 or 4 seconds. It's moving a little bit. So when we put it through a video game, at first that video game is going and it's moving and then it's stopping. It's moving and stopping without you doing anything. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is you're watching that and maybe it's a car race. In your car, all of a sudden when your brain relaxes that area, it starts racing by other cars. The background lights up. The music starts. It feels good. And then every time that brain activity goes back up to where it was, it stops and the music goes away. So, you know, I always tell people, this is like taking your dog, give them a treat whenever they sit, pull away the treat whenever they stand. Keep doing that. The dog does not have to understand the rules. They will start sitting. They figure out the association of sitting in this position. Your brain starts figuring out, instead of going 3 seconds start, 3 seconds stop, mm-hmm. what happens is that game starts going for 10 seconds, 15 seconds, 20 seconds. And then, in fact, as soon as the brain goes back up to where it was, it just starts to fade out the screen and the brain says, oh, I know what to do. And it pushes it back down again and it keeps it going. And then we can go to 2%. Then we can go to 3%. We can just literally train that right down to a normal level.
Hey, I got to ask you, something that's near and dear to, I know my partner and I's heart is mental health. And I think the last couple of years, I don't know if it's because I'm more cognitive aware of it, but everybody focused on this pandemic. Yeah, I think the true pandemic was opioids increasing. I think it was mental health. I think it was suicides. And have you seen an uptick in the opioid use, the mental health issues,
or has it always been there and it's just now people are paying attention to it more? What have you seen in your world in the last couple of years, and how are you handling that?
Well, I think it's, in some ways it's both, right? There's definitely an uptick in this, a huge uptick. But the problem is everybody for years was already accumulating up to a pretty high level, okay? Mm. And this pandemic is what really triggered everything way over that physiological threshold. And so it's, you know, it's kind of like they talk about, you know, with COVID, right? If you have an underlying condition that's right on the edge already, you introduce any type of sickness, anything that's going to cause inflammation throughout the body, it's going to hit those areas and those people are going to have problems. Absolutely. You know, and it's the same thing with mental health, is that a lot of people that had a lot of resilience that were way down here, they may have come up a little bit, but they're doing pretty well. But the people that were right on the edge already, this just, you know, exposed all that.
Wow. That's great. That's great stuff.
So I think anyone listening, whether they're, doesn't matter where, if they can find somebody that can get their brain mapped, that could help a lot of people at least get a direction of something other than a big pharma pill. It can give them a direction of hope and a direction of something that they can do. It'd make the chiropractor's job easier adjusting people. It'd make the psychologist's job easier of getting into their head and helping people. It'd get the MD, the trainer, everybody some help, because at least it gives them some direction.
Absolutely. Hey, yeah, the problem with medication medication can sedate something. So if I'm right near that baseline, I can sedate it and try and keep it lower. But that's really no different than having a major knee injury and saying, well, I just take, you know, a bunch of Advil all day long and I'm fine. Right. Well, the problem is you're not addressing it and it's getting worse. Mm. You know, a study came out a couple of years ago, that said that the headline said that women that take anti-anxiety medication have a, you know, almost tenfold chance of developing dementia. Okay. Now, it sounds like the medication is causing the dementia from the headline. It really, when you look at the study, it wasn't about that. Really, what they did is they, you know, women that take anti-anxiety medication is a pretty strong demographic of women with anxiety, right? And the problem is the medication is just covering it up. So now they're not seeking cures. So you just live your life that way. And so many people, these medications were meant to be on for 6 months to a year. And now people are on it for 10 to 20 years. Mm. And so anxiety is where groups of neurons are firing off huge amounts. It's constantly firing off. Neurons cannot fire off that much, nor can you keep a muscle flexed all the time without it eventually breaking down. Nor can you keep your heart rate up too high without it having a high risk of cardiovascular disease. Those neurons will break down 10 to 15 years before the rest of your brain in that area. And if it's in the temporal lobes, it's going to cause more Alzheimer's. If it's in the central strip of the brain, it can cause more Parkinson's or motor function. If it's in the frontal portion of the brain, it can cause more vascular dementia and you can have problems. The back of your brain, you can lose your balance. You can lose vision. Mm. You know, so to get a brain map every so often and understand, is there areas that are overfiring? Dementia is one of the most preventable diseases there is. Yet once you get it, you can't reverse it. You know, and I always explain to people that dementia, the pandemic of dementia in our country right now, huge, would be like if you never had a dentist. You've never heard of a dentist. And we always wonder why at 70, everybody's teeth are falling out. Okay. If you don't do any prevention on this stuff, some of these things are simple nutritional fixes. You know, omega-3 fatty acids, those are essential fatty acids, what 40% of your brain's made of. You know, most people have no clue if they're making enough or have enough in their brain to keep those connections solid or not.
Wow. Oh, that is something that our listeners should embrace, the omega-3s, you know, for brain health and, you know, nervous system. That's so important. People don't realize that. So let me ask you, I'm going to ask you, what are the most common, what's maybe the one or two most common things that you've seen that you have helped? And I also want to ask you about ADHD, because the Adderall use is going through the roof.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say the most common is going to be sleep problems. Okay. I would say 25% of anxiety issues, 25% of attention deficit issues are due to dysregulations in sleep cycles. And you know, if you're not getting into that deep sleep, the problem is, you know, our bodies have lymphatic systems. The lymphatic system drains out all the metabolic waste, the toxins, right? Your brain is the only part of your body that does not have a lymphatic system. Okay. And yet it has more cells than the entire rest of your body. And they, every one of those cells produces waste products. Okay. Right. Sleep is the only time, and I'm talking about quality sleep. It's not like, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I get good sleep. I can sleep 10 hours and I still feel tired. That's not good sleep. That's your body trying to make up quantity for quality. Okay. And, you know, quality sleep, when you're getting through the good quality sleep cycles, only in that deep stage of sleep do the vascular system of your brain, it actually shrinks down. The cerebral spinal fluid flows through those areas. It picks up all that metabolic waste, the plaques. A lot of people think, well, plaque is what, you know, develops into dementia. We produce plaque every single day. Okay. When you have plaque in your arteries all the time. It's the accumulation of that plaque that causes the problem. And same thing in the brain. If you're not cleansing out that plaque every day and every night, then it's accumulating. And decade after decade, that starts building up. You know, and at first what happens is it gets into the membrane of the cell and it starts to clog up the cell so neurotransmitters don't fire very well. Okay. So it stops the production of, or the transmission of serotonin, of dopamine. And so then you start having anxiety disorders. If it's low dopamine, you start having attention deficit. So what do? We go and have a stimulant medication. We have, you know, an SSRI. And, you know, what people don't realize is an SSRI, it doesn't give your brain serotonin. It multiplies your own serotonin. So if you have a sleep problem and you're not producing much, it's multiplying. It's trying its best to multiply as much as it can. It keeps that uptake from happening so it stays in there. And but the problem is your brain has its own sensors that sense, oh, now I'm producing too much serotonin. So it starts producing less itself. And so it keeps producing less and less, and we keep giving more medication, which then says, oh, I'm still producing so much more. And it causes a real problem. What we need to do is fix our sleep issue. And we fix our sleep issue, mental health, I'd say 25% of mental health could be fixed just by focusing on sleep.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. Sleep is very underrated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and a big factor, what appears in some of our patients is that, you know, again, diet, but not just from a nutritional, you know, nutritional standpoint, feeding the brain and body and all that, but also, you know, if you want a good night's sleep, you don't want to have a big, you know, a certain type of meal. You might want to have something small, readily digestible because of the interruption that is caused by competition with the belt, you know, digestion and blood flow in the brain.
Absolutely.
Any thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I tell people all the time, if they have a hard time falling asleep, you know, you don't want to be taking even, you know, protein's good for you, but protein activates the brain. So we don't want to take large protein right before we go to bed. You know, at dinner time, a few hours before is fine, but a lot of people go try and have, you know, a bunch of protein right before they go to bed. The other thing I think that causes a lot of problem too is, you know, there's so much association between metabolic health and blood sugar levels and with brain health and stuff too. And, you know, so many people have spikes or drops in their blood sugar level, which will wake them up in the middle of the night. And they have this little, you know, it feel like they can't fall back asleep, their brain's on and stuff. Well, that's if your blood sugar is dropping in the middle of the night, your brain's in emergency mode. What's going on? I need to figure out this and stuff too. So having things that can stabilize, you know, have a bunch of carbohydrates right before you go to bed, especially simple carbs, you're going to get a drop, you know. And so, you know, eating the right thing to stabilize blood sugar, to not activate the brain, is real important.
That's a huge one because, you know, we have friends that have, you know, that glass of wine or two or three before bed and they, oh, I'm going to get such a good night's sleep. But depending on the wine too, you got a blood sugar rise and fall.
Good point.
Any comments about alcohol and its effects on the brain?
Well, that's why it's important to stick with tequila.
A good tequila, not that Cuervo crap.
A good tequila, exactly. Thank you, Terry. Yeah, the quality of the alcohol is where it all comes down to. Right?
So. I'm a Casa Amigos guy.
Oh, I like their mezcal.
Oh, I just had some for the first time the other.
What's the topic of this show exactly?
We're going to switch gears now. Alcohol and the brain.
So alcohol, you know, again, I would argue that sugar in alcohol is the worst, right? When you have like this margarita full of sugar, you know, or other types, so much of alcohol is mixed with sugar. You know, that's going to be the worst. But even just regular alcohol does suppress some of the deep sleep cycles at night. And that's why a lot of people will kind of wake up, they'll fall asleep quick. You know, it's very much like, you know, Ambien, Lunesta, all these type of over-the-counter type medications, you know, or some of these general sleep medications that people take. You can fall asleep. And I always have to say it's torturous not to fall asleep. So I understand why people take it, right? I mean, it's torturous just to lay there and your brain's just going. But the problem is it stops you from getting a deep sleep cycle. So even once you do that, you wake up the next morning, you still feel like crap, right? You don't feel like, oh, I got the best sleep from these sleep medications. And same thing from alcohol. Typically people will, you know, fall asleep quick. So it feels good that I fell asleep quick, but you wake up the next morning, you have low energy. You know, you just don't feel the same, you know, and obviously depending on how much you drink, but even, you know, a glass of wine and stuff that, you know, it's hard. You know, the problem with these generalizations of that this is bad for you or this is good for you is it depends on your starting point, right? And that's from a brain map. We can see if someone already has a lot of sleep problems and they're already kind of right on the edge already of that threshold, little bit of alcohol can cause a lot of problems. Someone that doesn't, alcohol once in a while might not cause much problem at all.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So let me ask you, we started to dive into this. Let's say a kid, teenager, let's say Lance shows up to your office. He's on Adderall. He needs to be.
Because he was beaten by his father.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. And he's trying to make up for it by showing, hey, look, I'm taking vitamins. Look, no. Anyway, all kidding. But, you know, what would you do with a kid that, you know, the parent is concerned and actually a little conscientious about the fact that they may be on Adderall for the rest of their life? How would you start? What would you do with something like that?
So,
or Vyvanse.
Or Vyvanse, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, with medication, I look at it as what we want to do is try and get them to the lowest dose that their body needs. Okay. So I'm not anti-medication. I believe that people should be on the lowest dose their body needs. Now, I believe 99.9% of people, their lowest dose should be none. So you could argue I'm a little bit towards that. But, you know, there are some people, I mean, if someone's coming in and, you know, is having suicidal tendencies and stuff, to sedate the heck out of their brain at a point for a little bit of time while we address the underlying cause might be okay, right? And, you know, if Lance came in, you know, I mean, with his father and family history, I mean, there's not much we can do with that, you know.
Fair enough.
Exactly.
No, I hear foster home in the future.
Exactly. Exactly.
I will be moving in with my godfather in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, right.
So we would do a brain map, and I'd love for the kids to be there. The kids need to be there because they need to see the physiology that's in their brain that's causing this. First of all, it gets rid of the stigma of my focus just isn't strong enough. I'm not as good as other people. I love to show kids that, you know what, you're actually trying twice as hard as the kid next to you without this issue. Okay. Mm-hmm. If you have this slowing in your brain, it's kind of like, you know, if you were tired and driving home, do you know how hard it is to stay awake and stuff? You turn up your music, roll down your window, you do all these things. And that's why they create this hyperactivity. That's why a kid's looking here and here and doing everything. They're stimulating their brain to be able to try and hold their attention. So they're trying twice as hard as someone else and yet being told that they failed every time. So if you're trying twice as hard and then being scolded or told to trail, you know, you failed, or you need to sit up here, you're distracting the rest of the class, you're doing this, you're this. Most kids aren't going to just keep trying. Okay. They're trying twice as hard as someone else and yet being told that they're not doing the right thing. And so I think it's good for a kid to see this is physiology. You, and I love to tell the parents, this kid is trying twice as hard as everybody else. And they're usually like, oh man, I feel bad that I've been, you know, on him so much and everything with this. And I said, what we need to do is fix the physiology. You would not be taking this kid and telling him, lift that if he had a broken arm, right? Because we know that broken arm stops you from lifting something. And so first of all, we show its physiology. We remove the stigma of this mental health stuff. I love the idea. It's brain health, not mental health, right?
Yeah.
It starts with this brain health side. And we've got to fix that. And once they can see it, they realize we can fix it. And we show them what we're going to do and how we're going to fix this. And I always have them stay on the medication they're on. You don't want a big withdrawal effect right when you're trying to train someone. That stimulation, if you have a lot of slowing in your brain, it's like if you're driving home, you could drink some coffee or a Red Bull or caffeine, right? I mean, you could, and that would help you stay awake. You don't want to do that all the time. But then what we do is we address that physiology and bring it down. Basically, we're waking up that area of the brain so it's into full, neurons are firing correctly and stuff. And then they can slowly titrate off that medication and they don't feel any effect as they titrate off and they actually feel better. So, that, and then we brain map it afterwards to make sure it was totally gone. So they saw where it is, they see it's gone. And now there is the side where now you have to change your behavior a little bit, right? Now you have the habit of being maybe the class clown because you kind of gave up on this education stuff and you do things. So now that's why I like the final brain map where you show that you don't have this anymore. You have the habit that this created, but when you try now and you try and spend 5 minutes concentrating on something, you're going to succeed. And I mean, that's huge. And they start doing it and it builds up their self-esteem, their confidence and things too. And I always tell them, pull out that last brain map and look at it. Every time you think you have this still, it's just your habit. Look at that last brain. There's no physiology there anymore. I can actually do this and you can go right through and do it well.
So Brian, I actually have a question.
Yeah.
So with all these brain and obviously psychological problems and diseases that we have in our world today and the medication used to do them, how much do you know about the psychology's reproducibility crisis? Have you heard about that?
No, go ahead.
So there's a crisis in psychology where over 60% of the tests that medications are based on for like diseases, like what is ADHD and all that stuff. When they would go back and this group, I think it was called Many Two, went back and they tried to tackle psychology's biggest experiments with the brain. And they found that 60% of these experiments, when they tried to reproduce them again, fell right through. Right. And many of these experiments that all this medicine and medication and the biggest one is ADHD that is founded on is just complete BS.
Right. Interesting.
So and that's why I said Vyvanse back like 5 minutes ago is because Adderall and Vyvanse are these two giant drugs that are affected by this. And when you look, and then when you dive deeper into the issue, you find that these giant pharma companies have also tied in with Congress and all this other stuff so that they can, and have lobbied to keep this psychological reproducibility crisis under the wave so that they can keep selling these drugs. Because I think it was within like 5 years of Adderall first coming out, $5 billion alone from kindergartners and preschoolers from just being on these drugs. So I was wondering if you knew anything about that, because it does so affect your brain health with little kids being on this ADHD medication.
So Lance, are you actually trying to make the argument that pharmaceutical companies are motivated and influenced by money?
Yes. I don't know.
Yeah, really? Oh, man.
They're a demon. No, but my question is, since you do brain mapping, have you ever, especially for kids with ADHD, do you get a lot of them coming in, or do you measure a lot of kids, and what do those brains look like, especially if they're on Adderall? And can you yourself prescribe, like, this kid should be on a limiter, or this kid is fine, he's just a little kid who has energy?
So here's the thing with, psychiatry and psychology are the only medical fields that it's 100% subjective. There's no imaging. A diagnosis of anxiety or attention deficit would be like you going to your orthopedic surgeon, telling them all about your back pain, them writing a bunch of notes and saying, okay, I got your diagnosis. Your diagnosis is pain. Okay. That is not a diagnosis. That's a symptom, right? We want our orthopedic surgeon to say, you have a herniated disc from this to this, you know, or this area, this. You want something that's causing the pain. We don't want them to regurgitate the symptoms we just told them. So in psychiatry, you have you who doesn't have a clue really of what's going on. You just kind of know how you feel. And you're trying to describe to someone how you feel. And when you say, I have anxiety, that could be totally different from someone else's experience of anxiety or depression. Mm-hmm. And then you have someone that's taking that and just subjectively saying, okay, you have a diagnosis of this. You filled out these questionnaires, these subjective mm-hmm. questionnaires, and you met this certain number of symptoms. So therefore, you have this diagnosis. And the problem with that way of thinking is that's basically saying everybody with attention deficit has the same thing. Everybody with anxiety has the same thing. And a diagnosis should be about physiology. A diagnosis should not be about a bunch of symptoms that are clustered together. And so that's the problem with a lot of those studies, is that they're all based on subjective things. And, when you take even any type of thing, like say nutrition, and the pharmaceutical companies love to show studies that say, oh, nutrition doesn't work. Well, that's because you've taken, okay, you have all these people with anxiety. You give them one specific type of nutrition or one type of supplement. And now people that were deficient in that and their anxiety is caused because mm-hmm. of the deficiency, that's going to help them. But people that weren't deficient in that, it's not going to help them. So you can't just blanket this across the whole group of people. Yet the pharmaceutical companies will do that all day long in their studies. You know, I've worked on a lot of studies with, you know, top scientists that do this. And, you know, this one guy told me, who's done tons of it for different pharmaceutical companies, he said, if you give me enough money, I can do enough parallel tests and I will find one that supports what we're trying to do. You know, and that's the problem, you know, is that they have enough money to be able to do that. And then they throw away the 99 studies that failed. They focus on the one study here, and that becomes the gold standard.
Yeah. On an earlier podcast, I had shared a friend of mine that I went to high school with that became a medical doctor and then opened her own four-level pharmaceutical research. Man, long story short, she was definitely taking the payola to remove the, you know, the subjects that didn't quite fit the criteria.
Absolutely.
It was something else.
Absolutely. So I think, Lance, that's why there's so much change and no reproducibility. If you're looking, you know, like even omega-3s, you'll see 50% of studies that come out show no benefit from omega-3s, and 50% of studies show significant benefit from omega-3s. Okay. Why is that? You can't have randomly one show significant benefit, next one show no benefit. Well, first of all, there's no consistency in dose. Okay. So, you know, it's all self-reported. Oh, I take omega-3s. I don't take omega-3s. Well, studies show that, you know, that you have to take at least about 1,500 milligrams of EPA and DHA, which are the omega-3s inside of fish oil, to get much effect at all. Any study that has less than 1,500 shows no benefit, 99% of them at least, and all of them that above it will show significant benefit. So if you just randomize all those studies together, and then, you know, with omega-3s, you have rancid oil. I mean, you have, so it's fish oil. Right. It breaks down. Okay. When you get that burp taste of fish, it's rancid. Okay. And let's not even go into whether rancid oil is bad for you or not. Let's just go into at least it's not doing anything for you. Right. So you have that. You know, when you go to Costco, you see 1,000 milligrams of fish oil. And then you look in the back, it says 100 milligrams of EPA, 100 milligrams of DHA. So that's only 200 milligrams. And the rest is crushed up fish fat that goes bad so quick, gives you that terrible burp taste. And you're getting 200 milligrams, and the minimum you need is 1,500 to get anything done. So you could say all day long, yeah, this group takes omega-3s and there's no benefit, you know, and that's the problem with those type of things, is that when it's all subjective, any study for omega-3s that's done blood testing and looked at the actual absorption, how much omega-3s are in the membrane of the red blood cell, and then you compare those people, and when you increase that, you're going to show benefit. We did large benefits for that, or large studies for that for the U.S. Army, where we took blood samples and we showed cognitive performance in soldiers, along with increased resilience and to stress and all kinds of things.
That's so great. That's great. Well,
I'll tell you, I could probably keep you on this call all day. I love this brain stuff and mapping and remapping and, you know, identifying in a natural way how people should really shift their consciousness to other alternatives that may not be as popularized because it's hard to compete with the pharmaceutical industry or a psychologist or a psychiatrist that all they can do is write you a prescription, you know, and it's a lot cheaper to do that. But what you're doing is great. And however we can help you in this frontier of brain health is that to me is paramount.
You know, Spencer, there's two parts to that. There's definitely the pharmaceutical industry that's pushing it, but there's also us consumers are so lazy. We want a quick fix without fixing the core. Right. Yeah. We want a quick fix. Yeah. Give me that pill. I don't want to change my lifestyle. I don't want to stop this. I don't want to do this. You know, going to bed early, I have to work. Are you kidding? Yeah. I can't do that. I can't do this and stuff. So we got to stop the laziness too.
Yeah.
At the same time.
I think you just hit it on the head.
It's not much. Yeah. It's not much different than a gym membership. They, you know,
right.
The spas and the gyms, they make their money because people,
yeah,
you know, they mean well. They pay out a big bunch, and then they never show up.
They pay out in January.
Imagine if everybody showed up to the
In January for their New Year's resolution, and it's gone. You know, but one thing that this episode also gave me hope is, you know, we're at our pinnacle of our career near the, I hate to say it, but near the end of our career, and well, I mean, 30 years in.
Maybe Lance.
And then we have Lance, who's 19, who asked one of the best questions and is actually paying attention to some of these studies and seeing some of the problems at college. But I think people are starting to wake up a little bit. I think these last 2 years. Yeah.
Brian, when you scan my brain when you get home, you'll have to tell me how good my hippocampus is.
Exactly.
But yeah, I guess my point is people are – I think these last 2 years, they're starting to wake up and realizing that, you know, staying indoors, eating crappy food, not talking to people is not right. And taking these pills, taking these shots is a quick fix. It's not right. And so I think people like our engineer, like Spencer's kids, I think we have this wave of the next generation waking up to hopefully to be a much better than even what we did. And so I think that's always nice if people want to put down the next generation. Oh, the world's crazy. I'm not going to raise kids in this environment. I have a different outlook on that. I think, you know, if we can wake up and have this next wave of humans wake up to a better life form, I think it's better. And I think brain mapping is a great tool that people don't think about, you know, and if we can get everybody to sit and listening to us right now and going, I need to get my brain mapped to find out how I can be better. You know, they want to work out. They know they walk 20 minutes, they feel better. But I think starting with the brain is a great tool. So I really appreciate your insight and your time for hopefully helping a lot of people out there. Cause that's the goal of this podcast is to help people mentally, physically, nutritionally. So I appreciate
it. And you know, so many people, when they come to us, they're scared. They're scared of mapping their brain.
Mm.
And I always tell them, you know what you should be scared of is not mapping your brain.
Oh, okay? There you go.
Because, you know, honestly, mapping your brain is not, it's not like we tell them, oh, you got a good 30 days left. You know, it's like, it's not like that. Okay. It's like you can find areas that are just at the start of problems that you can quickly course correct and not lead to massive destruction in that area of the brain later on. So it's like going to a fitness trainer and then analyzing all your muscles and say, you know what, your back injury or your back pain you're having is because your core's, you know, weak. Let's do some things to, you know, to target that core area and strengthen it up. And I mean, that's not scary to say that. And really it's the same as the brain. The brain, it's not, we're not looking at your thoughts. We're not looking at how smart you are. We're looking at a resting state of your brain's electrical activity. It's brain health. And we got to get that through to people. That's brain health. It's prevention. And also, by the way, it makes you sleep better, have more energy, and sharper and more focused right now. So that's great and protects your brain later on.
Right. Fantastic. Well, I appreciate everything you did for us, Brian. And, you know, down the road, I think we'll have you on again just to keep pounding this into people to keep it mentally health. I think mental health is such an important aspect in the world right now. And so anything we can do to help people. So thank you for your time, buddy.
Awesome.
I'll see you soon.
Perfect. Thanks. Take care, guys.
Appreciate you.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Kraken Backs podcast. We hope you enjoyed, and make sure you follow our Instagram at the Kraken Backs podcast. Catch new episodes every Monday and Thursday. See you next time.